social media has kind of changed how we interact. We're like, people are always present in our lives in some way.
Yeah, it's like, I know you have kids. I've seen pictures of your kids. Like,
right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You got a new job. I saw that. Congrats. Yeah,
I saw it on LinkedIn. I sent you a congrats.
Hi, and welcome to the episode of Cine Nation. I am Brandon Sparks.
And I'm Ben Gertz.
And I'm Thomas Horton.
And we got a great episode for you today. But first, let's follow up on the last one we did. We did Movies on Movies. Did we talk about Orson Welles a little bit with his movies that were on Netflix and everything? Mm-hmm. Kind of the past few weeks. I've been reading his book. It was called This is Orson Welles. And it's a good like companion piece to those films. And I just wanted to kind of talk about it because we covered it in the show. And it's called This is Orson Welles. And it's like interviews with Peter Bogdanovich and Bogdanovich, I know, is like one of Thomas's, isn't it one of your favorite directors?
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, okay. For sure.
And so Bogdanovich, he did like The Last Picture Show, Paper Moon, all these. He was a good friend with a lot of these like old directors like John Ford. Mm-hmm. And Orson Welles wanted to set the record straight about himself, and he wanted Bogdanovich to interview him for this entire book. And so they basically go throughout his entire career, and they reference Other Side of the Wind, which is the Netflix film. And at this point when they published it, it had never been seen or never been released anywhere. And Welles has already died when the book got published. There was like no idea if it would ever get released. So it's a good like companion piece to the Netflix stuff that came out. It's a very interesting read, and you kind of see Welles goes in like, what was the downfall of his career? And his downfall was like, he was sent off to do like a documentary in South America, and that basically screwed over his entire career is what it was.
So he doesn't think his champagne commercial was the downfall.
Okay. So to put perspective into that champagne commercial, it's actually kind of admirable, is that basically Welles said, he goes, I don't like acting, but I'll sell myself out for acting to make the money to make the films I want to make.
Yeah.
So he would take every acting role he could just so he can make Other Side of the Wind or Chimes at Midnight or Othello. He was like, I don't care what I do acting wise, as long as I don't sell myself out as a director. He's like, I don't care about me as like an actor. I want to make sure that my movies are true to what I want to make. So I'll do whatever I can to make that happen.
Yeah.
Which is like kind of admirable for him to do. Like, he's like, I'm never going to take a job I don't want just for a paycheck.
I just did a little bit of research on some of his acting gigs, and I have something that I can tie back to our first episode, the Christmas movie episode. Were you aware that in 1977, Orson Welles played Mr. Potter in a gender swapped TV remake of It's a Wonderful Life?
Wow. No.
Wow.
With Marlo Thomas as Mary Bailey and Cloris Leachman as her guardian angel Clara.
This is a thing.
Are there any surviving prints of this masterpiece?
On YouTube.
This is going to go out in the show notes, please, for sure. Wow.
It's called It Happened One Christmas. Is that what it is?
Amazing.
I think we're kind of speechless.
Christopher Guest was Harry Bailey.
It was shot by Conrad Hall, and Conrad Hall shot Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and Cool Hand Luke and Road to Perdition.
Wow.
And this is post Butch Cassidy.
Wow.
Guys, I think we're speechless here. I think we can just end the episode right now. It's just like a short, like, I mean,
what a find, Thomas. This is incredible.
I just saw that he was credited as playing I wouldn't have noticed the title of the movie, except he's credited as playing a character named Henry F. Potter, and I was like, wait a second.
It's never been issued on DVD, but you can find it on YouTube, so...
Yeah, thank you to whoever had it on a VHS sitting around, taped off of television, probably.
ABC's Holiday Classic is what the cover on Letterboxd says.
I think, should we make this a corner for every episode, how we relate Orson Welles back to our previous episode?
Yes.
This will be the Orson Welles corner.
All right. So, Ben, I got an important question for you to go with our topic today.
Yes.
Did you go to your 10-year class reunion?
Oh, Brandon. I didn't go They had one for college.
Really?
And I did not go. Yeah. They do them every 5 years. There's like a 5, 10, 15. I might go to the 15.
Is it standard to do a 5? My class did not do a 5. The class above mine did.
Neither did we.
I know the kids a year older than me did a 5, but I never heard a word about a 5.
Well, I don't know why you want to do a 5. It's like you're like maybe 1 year out of college or still in college, like most people. You're
because,
like,
well, this was
because getting together with people
that were doing 5, yeah. Yeah.
Getting together with people you grew up with is a wonderful, treasured time, and that's what we're here to talk about.
Thomas, what are we here to talk about?
Talking about, you know, just getting back with the people who knew you when you were young and just right. Living life.
Are those like what are those? Are those reunions?
Yeah, reunions. That's what they're called. When you do get back together with those people, it's something unpredictable, but in the end, it's right.
You're winning right now, Thomas. You are definitely in the lead. Definitely in the lead.
Oh man. Okay. I don't know how to follow up on that comment. But yeah, we're talking about reunion movies, and that I want to see what Ben if he went to his reunion. It's a weird time nowadays with reunions because with social, like back in the day, like even in the 90s or early 2000s, it's like social media has really changed how we like see like interact with people. Like back then, you literally didn't know what these people were doing unless you like kept in contact with them. And nowadays it's like with social media, you see them all the time. Like literally, I saw someone out in my hometown when I was back for Christmas, and my mom was just asking about him. And so I looked him up on Facebook, like, oh yeah, he's doing this or that. And then I see him out at a bar, and it's one of the most awkward exchanges I've ever had, or I've had in a while. Cause it's like, oh, hey. And I realize even though he was like just in my mind and just saw his picture and like saw what he was doing, I realized we hadn't talked in like 7 years, and it was just kind of like, he didn't even know who I was. It felt like, I'm like, oh, okay. This is very awkward. So it's social media has kind of changed how we interact. We're like, people are always present in our lives in some way.
Yeah. It's like, I know you have kids. I've seen pictures of your kids. Like,
right. Yeah. Oh yeah. You got a new job. I saw that. Congrats. Yeah,
I saw it on LinkedIn. I sent you a congrats.
It's like, oh, how was that vacation in Hawaii last year? It's just, it's very, and because of that, we might not see reunion movies in the same way we used to. We don't see a lot of great ones nowadays. But I think, Ben, you're about to say something.
Well, no, it was just the point that you were making, that it's a one-way, it can be a one-way observation, right? It's like, you're following this other person, and the other person's not following you back in that same way. And so, yeah, the conversation is uniquely different. I mean, I think I got some of these this year, right, where like people sent Christmas cards with Christmas letters. Uh-huh. And I think that's just the most bizarre, like in a modern era where like they're so great, you know, and it's written, there's a tone to it that there is a template somewhere. Like people are filling these things out from some sort of like website. But I don't know. I love them.
We have this,
anyway.
We have this one family that sends them every year, and it's just like everything good has happened. Is like, it's just like every single kid they have is the smartest kid, and then it's the best at whatever they're doing. And they didn't send one this year, and it was the most disappointing thing about my entire Christmas was I didn't get to hear what that family was up to.
Yeah, you don't know what's happening. It's probably not good though.
Yeah, if they didn't send one out, it's like, wow, they couldn't think of anything good to write.
Jimmy got C's this year.
Oh no, we're not sending a letter. Way to go, Jimmy. You ruined the Christmas letter.
So anyway, again, I'm in the middle of like, I think I'm a year and a half out from my 10-year reunion, if we have one. But when I go home, we always have a conversation with a few friends. It's like, hey, are we going to do this and plan it? Or are we just going to like not, like just forget about it? And it's like been a conversation for the past like 6 to 7 months, like, if we want to do it, we got to like start planning it. Cause like it takes a time to actually do a reunion. If you're doing like a big high school reunion type thing. I see all my college friends. I don't have to have a reunion with the college friend when like, it's like, I can't keep in contact with people I want to keep in contact with. But if Ben goes to his reunion, I want to hear what happens. Like we should do an episode just of like,
oh boy. Yeah. Let's make a documentary about it. No, I mean, I might go back.
When would it be? When would it be? Not to date you in the 15 year.
Not to date me. 20. If I went to the 15, it would be 2022.
Okay. Yeah. So you just kind of missed the 10-year.
I just missed the 10-year. And okay. I mean, I was on the fence, but like, I don't know. I'm with you, Brandon. It's like, there's a strange thing where it's like, we were close, we were friends, we were living in the same dorm, and then now we don't. I'm not on social media that much, so like, and I don't post that much, so mm-hmm. I'm going to show up and see these people and like start from square one. Like, that seems
that's how it's that meant seems to be
uncomfortable. I know that's how it's
you're
meant
supposed
to be.
To wear your name tags because you haven't even seen the person in 10 years and you have no idea what they're you're supposed to have. Yeah. That moment where you go, that's what so-and-so looks like now. And Instagram's yeah, ruined that.
Instagram and Facebook ruined that. Yeah. It's like, oh, well, your profile pic. Or you can go like, oh, your profile pic must be old because you look terrible now. Like, but like, so let's go back. Let's backtrack. Yeah. So we talk about movies. Like, so back in the day when they did these movies, that wasn't like that.
Right.
So it was always kind of a shocking thing if you saw someone. But what I want to talk about today, when I started doing this research for all these for this genre, and with this genre, by the way, it's surprisingly like even more niche than the past few ones we've done, it feels like, because we're all kind of going through that. We did a Letterboxd list like usual, and right now we have like maybe we have under 60 movies, which is kind of like the least we've ever done, and it's also like the lowest we've kind of seen as well. But what I started noticing is that the reunion movie kind of started again, like the Christmas episode we did. World War II kind of had a big effect on it. And so the first movie I can kind of find that was a big reunion movie was The Best Years of Our Lives. And I know, Ben, you've seen that movie as well. Do you want to talk mm-hmm. about that one? Because that's like about three soldiers who have come home from the war and run into one another.
Yeah. I mean, it's been years since I saw it. It was recommended, I think, in college, and I watched it, you know, at some point after. But I think it's one of those interesting. I found it interesting because I was surprised, I guess, by the weight of the from memory, right? The weight of the film. Like, there's actually, it has a very heavy subject matter, you know, and all these vets. And it's not the my childhood, right? I remember watching a lot of like John Wayne war movie, mm-hmm. Sands of Iwo Jima, like, you know, it's a lot of like rah-rah war movies, like White mm-hmm. Christmas or something, where it's like on a soundstage. It's the most ridiculous depiction of war ever. It's romanticized. And I think the interesting thing for Best Years of Our Lives, right, it's 1946. And it doesn't necessarily have that, like, it's a wonderful life, like, well, it all turns around and everybody's fine. You know, that it has a weight to it that I was surprised based on, you know, just my reference point of older films from the period. Like, I think it's a really, it's a surprising film. At least it was mm-hmm. for me, you know?
Yeah, it was. Well, and so it's directed by William Wyler. And it's some of the stuff you're talking about is very important for Wyler and why he made the movie. And so Wyler actually was one of those filmmakers who went off and did documentaries in the war during mm-hmm. World War II. And so this was his first film back after being in the war and doing all his documentary films. And he wanted to kind of showcase what it was like for a veteran coming home and how the war impacted their entire lives right from the beginning, right when they stepped foot in the U.S. soil, is how it changed. And with It Follows, like, I think three guys, and I think they all knew each other before the war, and you see how the war affected them, not just in a like a mental way with just like interacting with their selves, but also with their family lives. So they're coming back to a family that doesn't know what they've seen and what they've been through. Mm-hmm. And these veterans kind of have a special bond because they did it together, or they're in the same thing.
Right.
And another movie I want to talk about was It's Always Fair Weather. And it's a movie where these three veterans come home from the war, but it's also a little bit more happier, like, oh, we're back in U.S. soil, like, we're great friends, we'll always be great friends. And these three guys, it's Gene Kelly, directed by Gene Kelly and Stanley Doden, who did Singin' in the Rain. And the whole promise they make is in 10 years from now, we'll meet back up in New York City and we'll all be successful in what we want to do. And Gene Kelly wants to be a lawyer. He ends up being a gambler and a boxing promoter who fixes fights. One guy wants to be a painter. He ends up becoming an advertising person. and has a terrible marriage that's being ruined. And then one guy wants to be a gourmet chef, and he becomes a burger stand owner, is what it was. And they all forget about it, but they somehow wind up in New York on the day they're supposed to meet back and reunite. And they finally do, and they realize how they've completely changed in the past 10 years and how life in that 10 years like altered their entire state. And they weren't the rah-rah guys coming out of the war. It, like, life really had impact. And it's known for being like one of the more depressing musicals of like the Golden Age, because it kind of has a downbeat where like everything doesn't turn out the way you think it will.
Yeah, well, and I mean, Ben, even you brought up White Christmas, and Brandon and I were talking a little bit today about whether that would count, at least as, you know, the big, the grand finale is like bringing their entire company back together. But even something as like, you know, I don't know, rose colored as White Christmas is still takes a pretty hard look at, you know, the whole thing with the general being completely out of work and the army just kind of dumping him after he's done.
Yeah.
It was. It's a very interesting relationship between Hollywood and like the post-war. You know, during the war, you definitely had a lot of those like rah-rah war movies, but
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Almost yeah. immediately after, people started taking a much harder look at everything.
But I guess the point with White Christmas though, right, is that they take a just like It's a Wonderful Life, they take a really, I mean, It's a Wonderful Life, super dark elements. But yeah. by the end, it's all made right, yeah. and it's all, yeah. you know. And so I think it's interesting when films sort of settle into like, well, it's not all going to be all right. Like, well, you know.
And with White Christmas, it's kind of people focus on the good parts, the good yeah. moments of it.
Yeah, like, that's everybody's memory of it.
I mean, no one really remembers like Bing Crosby. I mean, at least to my knowledge, I don't. Like, you don't see pictures of Bing Crosby singing at when they're actually at war, when they're singing yeah. White Christmas. Which, like, in that context, is a very depressing song mm-hmm. to me, because he's talking about, like, what they don't yep. have
yep.
and being away from home. And that, it's, it, but yeah, what we're saying is that these are very interesting movies on seeing how veterans come home and how the war has affected them. Mm-hmm. And when they reunite, when they reunite, that's when they really realize just how much it actually did mm-hmm. affect them.
Well, and something where if you look at reunion movies, I think if you really narrow down what the theme is, for the most part, I think the overlying theme within the genre is like growing up. And yeah. it's interesting to kind of look at the different decades, how they approach growing up. The World War II movies yeah. are definitely about a group of people who are forced to grow up by the war yeah. and were like thrust into adulthood very quickly and are now dealing with it. Whereas as we get later on in some of the more modern films, it's more about the people who are having a very hard time putting themselves into adulthood. And a lot of the yeah. reunion movies kind of center on that, as using a reunion to, as a way to look back on your childhood and then somehow launch yourself into adulthood from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that kind of pushes us to like the new movement, which kind of starts popping up in late 70s, early 80s. And I was rewatching, it was kind of the big movie in the American film independent movement for the time was Return of the Secaucus Seven. And it was by John Sayles. And it's about these seven college friends who meet up every year at this like New Hampshire, like kind of like camping ground, basically, in this like small little town in New Hampshire. And all the seven, what kind of binds them together is that they used to be like not big anti-war protesters of Vietnam, but like that was what they were going through when they were in college, was the war in Vietnam. And they become known as the Secaucus Seven, they call themselves, because they were arrested for like an anti-war protest they did back in the day. And so you're seeing again how life has affected them and how in that most of them in that amount of time never really grew up, because they were like, one of the guys in the movie is like wanting to be a musician and it's 10 years out of college and he kind of sucks, but he's like, I'm going to Los Angeles to follow my dream, but I have no money, so we'll just see what happens. It's like there's no focus because they never had that pressure put on them to actually become an adult, like, say, with the war films earlier on. And we're talking about the reunions, what kind of prompts them to rethink – what they're doing. Either make a move or don't make a move. You have to do something. Mm-hmm. And with Sales, that's what he, I don't know if he meant to do that, but that's what it kind of portrays, is how much there's like a big breakup between one of the couples, and some of the couples are settling down, and you're starting to see like, oh, they're actually growing up. Maybe I should be doing that as well. And then that continues with Lawrence Kasdan's Big Chill. I'm going to let Thomas talk about that.
The quintessential reunion movie. I mean, if you bring this up as a genre to people, I guarantee you the majority of people you bring it up to are going to, The Big Chill is going to be the first movie that comes to mind.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I was looking at the reviews on Letterboxd for Secaucus 7, because you said, you know, Kasdan was accused of taking like a lot of stuff from Secaucus 7 to make Big Chill.
Yeah.
And a couple of reviews address that and are like, so what? Big Chill is a better movie than Secaucus 7. So.
And it is. I think it is.
So it happened. Even if it did happen, he did it successfully. But.
Well, it's like Secaucus 7 is the early forms of it, yeah, coming about.
Stellar cast. Lawrence Kasdan, Brandon and I were just talking about this today. We were watching a documentary about the making of Big Chill, and Kasdan was talking about how he was going around pitching it, and no studio wanted it. And I was like, if you put this in context of Kasdan's career, it's like you're some studio exec, and you're like, let's set up a meeting with Lawrence Kasdan. I want to hear what he's working on. Dude just did Empire Strikes Back and Raiders of the Lost Ark. You're like... Yeah, I want the next big movie this guy wants to do. And he comes in and he says, I want to get a bunch of like late 20-year-olds together after their friend commits suicide and just have them hang out in a house for a weekend. And you're going to be like, no, give me something with Harrison Ford punching people. but that's what it is. It's a whole bunch of friends who's one of their best friends, played by Kevin Costner, although never seen in the movie.
Except his hands and his hair. Yeah. That's it.
Has just committed suicide, and they're coming back together for the reunion. It's Kevin Kline and Glenn Close are married. Then there's Jeff Goldblum, William Hurt, Tom Berenger, Mary Kay Place, Joe Beth Williams, and Meg Tilly is his like Kevin Costner's girlfriend. And they just all stay over at Kevin Kline and Glenn Close's house for the weekend. And even though they're there for a funeral, it's the first time they've seen each other in years. And it's a very like joyous, it's a very bittersweet occasion, I'd say. But yeah, you know, the most famous scene is them dancing around to Motown while they're making dinner. It has an excellent soundtrack because Kasdan said when he was writing it, he wanted it to be the music that he listened to when he was in college, because these people would have been in college at the same time as him. And he wants, you know, a musical, time capsule to just take him back.
And he also, I think, like the characters were from Michigan, I think is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, I think, went to Michigan was the thing. So he very much like basically based it on people he went to school with, or what he saw was like what his experience would be like. But with Big Chill, that's the one that kind of set, or it feels like to me, set like the nowadays tropes of the genre of like a good reunion movie. Yeah. It's like some event has to happen to bring them together.
Somebody's got
to
be famous now. That's a big thing.
That's a big thing. One that makes it big is famous. And at first it's very joyous and happy, and I can't wait to see you. And then slowly delves into, you find out the reasons why they're not together anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or what's the arguments that brought them apart. So like in Big Chill, not really spoilers, but like the whole thing is that the Kevin Costner character that we never see, the guy who commits suicide, it's the whole, is he wasting his life just not doing anything? And he was so talented, could in all these big things, but he made either poor decisions or just didn't have good luck at certain things. And now they're all coming together and thinking, well, what if we could have been differently to him? But what if we... well, if we were leading our lives differently, how would it be? It established those kind of tropes, and also just the music aspect of it, and the almost contained, like, not really always a day, but mainly the weekend type aspect of it. And so many films followed that as the genre went on into present day, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it's just one of those, you talk about reunion movies, but it's also very influential in the idea of like the Hangout movie, and just the idea that if you get a really good cast together and give them very interesting characters, there doesn't necessarily have to be much of a plot to it.
Yeah, well, there was in the movie we're going to talk about later that I'm pitching, but in Ebert's review of it, he says, yeah, this movie's kind of compared to The Big Chill, but if you have witty dialogue, fun and interesting characters, it doesn't really matter if it's kind of the same thing. If the characters are different, you're going to get different stories and different conversations that make you think about certain things in life. And if it's done well, it shouldn't matter if it's kind of the same trope or whatever.
Yeah. And The Big Chill also introduces to move us on to some of our other films. The Big Chill is also one of the first ones, if you're going chronologically, to kind of bring funerals into the reunion genre, which ends up becoming a lot of the ones that come after it have to do with death or funerals. And that's a very interesting subject to approach.
Which I think any time in life, I mean, I had this recently where I had a family member die very suddenly. And just that death can make you rethink. It doesn't need a reunion thing, but it actually can make you rethink just the decisions you're making in life. Or maybe I should be doing something else. Or maybe I should work on the weight or work on this and make my life better because what brought about that or whatever.
To be in that state of mind and then to be surrounded by family or friends that you haven't seen in years makes for very interesting character arcs, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Because those characters can bring stuff out of other characters, because those are the ones that really know the foundation of who you are. Because they saw you when you're at your lowest and your highs, and now they can bring it back into perspective for you. But yeah, that's kind of signs of a good reunion movie. Now there's outliers that are I think a big outlier that some people like, some people hate is Ronnie and Michelle's high school reunion. That's not really in that realm of what we're talking about, but it's dealing with the union and it's dealing with the idea that no one wants to go back to your high school reunion and be a failure. And those characters hey, we're working at a retail shop and we're going back to our reunion where everyone's probably sexy and rich and married and they're single, not having any future in their mind. And so they start lying about what they actually did to make themselves look better at their reunion. I think the 90s, you start getting a different style of reunion films is what it is. With that and with Gross Point Blank, which is about John Cusack's a hitman who goes back to his high school reunion. But again, even with that, the reunion prompts people to rethink the decisions they're making in life. This kind of the thing. Doesn't have to be a death. But Thomas also brought up some stuff. You're talking about generational stuff about with the World War II movies, the Great Generation, and then with the Baby Boomer Generation, and the Big Chill is kind of Big Chill and Secaucus 7 is kind of the first in that Baby Boomer Generation type of reunion movie. And you kind of compared the Baby Boomers in those films to nowadays Millennials was your idea.
Yeah, it's interesting because you see so much stuff on the internet with Millennials complaining about the way that Baby Boomers have kind of set up the economy to just be all right, go get a job and don't complain about it. And everyone needs a little bit of perspective, because if you go back and watch some of these baby boomer movies, especially the ones like The Big Chill, where baby boomers are struggling to grow up themselves, they're going through very similar struggles because they feel like they've been set up by the Greatest Generation to come back and said, hey, we won the war, we saved the world, now go make something of yourselves. And there's a lot of pressure put on them to do that, and they just feel a little lost in how to make that happen. And it's kind of interesting to see it follows the exact same narrative that people now are depicting the struggle of a millennial in, and millennials turn and point their fingers at baby boomers, and baby boomers turn and point their fingers at the Greatest Generation. Just keeps going back and back.
That's interesting. I mean, I think I'd have to dig for this, but it's that idea that every older generation complains about the younger generation, and it had quotes from newspaper articles and articles showing how basically you can go back very, very far. And every time it's sort of a reoccurring theme of like, they complain too much and they're ungrateful and they're lazy and they're never going to get it together. And, you know, it just takes on different forms. And we've all, you know, you lose that context of history to realize, well, no, this is what it's like to be 50 and complaining about, you know, a person who's living in your basement or whatever.
I mean, Ben would know. Ben always sounds like an old man ranting about something. So it's...
Thank you. Thank you, Brandon. The compliments are strong today.
But yeah, it's like the parent-child thing. It's just like every child becomes the parent and goes through the same experiences their parents were going through, and you begin to realize like, oh, maybe I was kind of a terrible kid or whatever. It's like, it makes you rethink the things you did. Mm. And so, but yeah, I think, with reunion movies nowadays, I don't really know as many that fit into that style that we're talking about.
Something I think I've started to notice as you kind of look through modern reunion, especially reunion comedies, a lot of them center on, instead of like a group coming together and learning how to grow up together, a lot of them center on a group getting together in order to force one of them to grow up. Mm. At World's End is that way with Simon Pegg. The rest of the group is like all grown up and they don't want to do this bar crawl and they're just doing it for him. And also, usually a lot of them have like suffered some kind of tragedy. And that is the reason everyone agrees to get back together. Like Hot Tub Time Machine, it's been a long time since I saw it, but Rob Corddry just got like divorced or something, right?
I think so.
Somebody just got divorced and they're just going on like a divorce trip. And the one that got divorced is like an extremely immature one. And they're, mm-hmm. he needs to learn maturity through it. What's another,
another one's, it's not a comedy. Well, it's kind of a comedy in some way. Like Last Flag Flying is this dramedy where it's like the son dies, Steve Carell's son dies, and Bryan Cranston and Lawrence Fishburne help him take the kid back to get buried or whatever.
Yeah, the other one I was thinking about was here's another Christmas movie, The Night Before, that they get together for Joseph Gordon-Levitt's, like, because Joseph Gordon-Levitt lost his family, so they get together every Christmas, but this is like the last Christmas that they're going to do it, and he still hasn't really grown up yet. And also Anthony Mackie is famous in that one, so there you go, there's another trope.
You gotta have someone famous. Dude,
and that's a great movie, mm-hmm. too.
Well, and another thing you also had was like the screw up in the group, or like, mm-hmm. the screw up comes home and it can, you either can change them or they change you in some way. Mm-hmm. So like something like Rounders is like that, with Matt Damon and Edward Norton. Kind of reunion movie, like Edward Norton gets out of jail and Damon has kind of created this life that he had with before Norton came in, and Norton kind of makes him, like, it affects his life in a negative way, but it also helps Damon realize who he truly is in some way. Mm-hmm. Another good one is You Can Count on Me with Laura Linney and Mark Ruffalo, the original Manchester by the Sea, basically. It's Kenneth Lonergan, it's the same guy, but it's great. Laura Linney and Mark Ruffalo, and Ruffalo comes home because I think he's in some trouble with a drug dealer or something, I think, or something happens that prompts him to come home and like realize like how his life has turned out. And Laura Linney is also questioning the life she has as well too. But yeah, sorry, continue.
Wait, was I supposed to be continuing? I don't know.
I don't know.
I was just picking out like the more recent films, you know, and I think it might be because like the standard reunion film in modern era feels a little outdated, but like a lot of times now you kind of get that like getting together for like a specific tradition or something, and it's a lot of times it's like this is the last one, so it's a big deal. But another one, American Reunion, Stifler's the screw up coming back and needs to learn to mature, and Oz is famous. It's another famous one.
I did not realize until discussing this with us here is that is a big trope, is that someone has to be famous.
And a lot of times that's kind of the reason they fell out of contact, is like the famous person like drifted apart because they're famous, and everyone kind of harbors like some resentment towards them for that.
Well, yeah, I mean, this isn't really a reunion film exactly, but like Don't Think Twice, mm-hmm. the improv comedy film, right? I mean, there is like a reunion element at the end, right? Because Keegan-Michael Key becomes famous, and then they have, you know, the finale of the film is sort of them all sorting out by getting back together a little bit to talk through that. It's not the center of the film to be a reunion film, but it has a lot of these same tropes just kind of packaged in a different way.
Which is a great film, by the way, just a tangent.
It's a great
film.
That's Mike Birbiglia, that film is so well crafted, it's insane.
Yeah. Like, I've gotten into not Dark Now Dragouts, but I've gotten into, like, really heated arguments about that film because I know a lot of people that hate it, and I don't know why.
Yeah.
I think it's because they're like, it's not funny. I'm like, it's not really a comedy. Like,
it's not really a comedy. Yeah.
It's also the idea where everyone's rethinking the choices they're making in life.
Yeah, exactly.
And what they have to do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so I think it's like, it is sort of a reunion movie, but I think he you know, he's playing with it enough to kind of move it away from, but a hangout movie necessarily, even though it kind of has some of those same characteristics.
But yeah, and again, there's a couple outliers, like I said before, with Rami Michel. Blues Brothers, one of the greatest reunion movies of all time. I don't know if it follows any of the stuff we're talking about. Well, it kind of does. No, it does. Like, they have to get the band back together to raise money for the orphanage that raised them. And so that's their only way to get money is to put on a great, great slamming show in Chicago. And it's the greatest one of all time, guys. Greatest one of all time.
Brandon, while we're talking about modern reunion movies and going back to The Big Chill and how important a good cast is, do you want to talk about the movie we were talking about right before we started recording?
Yeah. So there's this movie called 10 Years that has a phenomenal cast. When you look at the cast, it's came out in 2011. It's literally just about a 10-year reunion, a high school reunion. And it stars Channing Tatum, Chris Pratt, Aubrey Plaza, Justin Long, Kate Mara, Oscar Isaac, Anthony Mackie, Ron Livingston, who's great in Office Space and many other things, Rosario Dawson. I feel like I'm forgetting someone. Jenna Derwin, who's Chang Tame's ex-wife. But just the cast is stacked. And again, it's kind of going with the tropes we're talking about, is that Chang Tatum was dated Rosario Dawson in high school, and now they've broken up years ago, and he's trying to propose to his girlfriend. Oscar Isaac is famous. He's a musician who had like this big kind of one hit that like everyone keeps asking, like, hey, I love that song, Never Had, or Best I Never Had, I love it, like, play it for me. He's like, no, I'm good. And like, that's the only song they know from him. And he really likes Kate Mara, and she has no clue who he is, like, as a musician. And like, she kind of doesn't even remember him from high school, or that's what she kind of appears to be like. And Chris Pratt is this guy who like was the like big football player, whatever, in high school, who was like a a-hole to all the nerds in school. And now he's like trying to apologize to all of them at the reunion, but he's like just being he gets drunk and is being a dick to everyone, basically, because he keeps annoying the nerds that were in high school. They're like, please just get away from us. Like, stop talking to us. It's like, it's an interesting film, just from the perspective of seeing all these really famous people before they become famous. All
right, I have a bit of a non sequitur, but this is what I really enjoy about breaking down these genres in this show, is you start to kind of realize when you start to realize the tropes and the character arcs and that sort of thing, you can start to branch out like we were doing with
Don't Think Twice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just had this realization that The Graduate is a reunion movie about when you don't have any friends to get back together with.
Wow.
It's about what happens when you have to hang out with your parents when you come back from college.
It's true.
Thomas, and that's good. you're on fire. What's happening?
But yeah, like the only person he knows is Mrs. Robinson. Yeah. That's kind of the thing.
He has to hang out with his parents all the time. All his parents' friends. He has no friends from growing up in his hometown anymore. But like if he, you could easily see that film going away, that like he gets back together with like two or three friends and it, the whole plot would go in a different direction.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's all about too, like, what am I doing with my life?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cause is it, he graduates from grad school, right? I'm trying to,
I think
to
it's just college. Sure it's yeah. Cause he was college? An athlete. He was like a star athlete.
And they're like, are you going to graduate school? Mm-hmm. And it's like, make a decision. And he's being forced to grow up in some way. Again, it's that generational thing where it's like, they're forcing him to grow up and he doesn't know what he should be doing. Mm-hmm. Like right. He doesn't want to grow up that fast. That blew my mind, Thomas.
But that's what's really fun about this, I think, is, yeah, is yeah, and I that's agree. What I'd really like to get doing is having, I'd love for our, like, you know, when we kind of go back at the beginning of an episode about the last genre, to get to the point where when people are listening and having other ideas about movies, they can send them in. Like we'll just say a listener who I know just got the day, I didn't even realize yet. I had just gotten up. I didn't even realize that our 24-hour movie episode had published yet. But I just woke up to a text that said, all it said was Clue is a 24-hour movie. And I went, oh my God, how did I miss Clue? Like, I love that movie. And that's the kind of stuff that's the more we talk about it, I want to get like other people's ideas and not even stuff that like fits the genre. But when you start getting outside of these ideas and you can say like so-and-so is a Christmas reunion movie with a touch of, you know, that also the night before, wait, does the night, is the night before a Christmas reunion movie that takes place in 24 hours?
Dear God. I think there's some elements that happen after, maybe, but it's basically, I think it's like, it might be like 48 hours.
No,
right?
It might, is it? I think it might be. I mean, there's like some flashbacks to the beginning, I think, right?
Yeah.
Well, but like Seth Rogen's wife gives him drugs, right?
Yeah.
And like the whole thing is basically timed around like how long it takes for their drugs to kick in.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because like, is it the end where he sees her face as a dragon or something like that?
Yeah, and they're just trying to get to that party that happens on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, it's all in one day.
Wow. So according to this podcast so far, The Night Before is the ultimate film.
But there is a 1 year flashback at the very end of the movie. Is what I just read.
Oh, okay.
So that might.
I think it totally fits the genre. It's the ultimate movie.
Of like everything we've talked about, basically.
Yeah.
Let me see what else. Because we're running low on time, so I think we might have to pitch stuff right now.
Yeah, are you guys going to pitch stuff to me or what?
Who won last time? Oh, yeah, that was Thomas.
Yep.
which, by the way, side note, with Movies on Movies episode, I pitched Get Shorty. And as of right now, you can stream that movie. It's on Crackle, if you guys know what that is.
I thought it got shut down, but okay.
Did it get shut down?
No.
No, I mean, okay. Wildly popular.
Is it free? I don't know if that's free anymore.
I thought it was
supposed
free.
Supposed to be free, but it has commercials.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
that's where Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee used to be.
Yeah.
It used to be.
That's where where the Get Shorty TV series is now.
No, that is it?
Yeah.
It's Epics. Oh, that was Epics.
That's only, yeah, it is. Epics. I totally forgot Epics is like a different thing.
Yeah, Crackle has Snatch. That's what Crackle has.
Yeah, the Snatch show. Yeah.
But yeah, if you guys want to go to Crackle, go watch Get Shorty.
Joe Dirt, too.
Who do you want to go first?
I'll let you go first.
Okay. All right, Ben. I got a great one for you.
Oh boy, let's do
Big
it.
Big question.
Yeah.
Do you like British entertainment?
Brandon, do I love British entertainment? I love it.
Exactly. Okay, I'm the guy for you, Ben.
Yes.
Okay, so this movie is called Peter's Friends, and it's the British version of The Big Chill, pretty much. It's directed by Kenneth Branagh.
Okay.
And Kenneth Branagh, who did a lot of like these early Shakespearean films like Hamlet and Henry V, and
now Dunkirk.
He's in Dunkirk, and he's great in Dunkirk. So Branagh directed this film. You ready for the cast, Ben?
I'm ready.
Okay. Stars Kenneth Branagh, Emma Thompson, Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie, Imelda Staunton, and another actress, Alphonsia Emmanuel, who doesn't act anymore. So they're all like college friends who are in this like cabaret together, and it has a flash, starts off with a flashback at the beginning when they're like performing at Peter, who's played by Stephen Fry, his like father's like kind of like big wig party. And mm-hmm. it's all done in one shot, by the way. It's like an 8-minute scene, so get ready. So basically, flash forward 10 years, Peter, his father has died, and he's about to sell his like big country estate. And New Year's is coming up, and he wants to have a party before he sells it. So he's like, I'm going to invite all the friends that are important to me that I haven't seen in a while because I have something to tell them they need to know about, and I'm going to bring them to the country estate and have just a New Year's Eve party. Mm-hmm. And so it's 10 years later, it's 1992. Hugh Laurie and Imelda Staunton. And Imelda Staunton was Dolores Umbridge in Harry Potter, for those who don't know who she is. They're like a jingle writing couple for like radio and TV. Kenneth Branagh is this like LA sitcom writer who's a bad sitcom, and he married the actress who's the lead in there. And he sold out, basically. He was writing plays mm-hmm. with Stephen Fry in England, and he got a deal to go to L.A. and just, like, up and left all his friends. And right. Stephen Fry's his best friend, but they have kind of lost touch over the years. And this is kind of bringing them back together because of Stephen Fry's father's death. Emma Thompson has, like, basically become a cat lady. It's like she wants to find a husband, and the only person she has is her cat. It's like her child. And so she's trying to hook up with Stephen Fry for the weekend because she wants to marry him, but she doesn't know if he's like gay because she's never seen him with a woman, or she thinks he might be gay, but she's not for sure. And so she never seen him with a woman and never really seen him with a man. So she's trying to figure it out because she wants to marry him. And then mm-hmm. Alfonsia Emmanuel plays this character who's like a famous like fashion designer, but she's known for like always hooking up with married guys. And so she brings a married guy to the get together. And so everyone's starting to go through stuff. Hugh Laurie and Imelda Staunton, they had twins, and one of them actually died when they were not too long after the birth. And so Imelda Staunton's always like worried about leaving their child alone, especially for this big weekend. And yeah. so that's causing strains on Laurie and Staunton, and like Laurie's thinking about like leaving her. And so like all these different things these people are going through gets brought back up, and kind of like we talked about before, it's all joyous and happy at first, but slowly you start seeing what's the root of all the problems with these characters and why they aren't together, right. or just how they change. They begin to play off one another. Great soundtrack. Bruce Springsteen, Eric Clapton, The Pretenders, and a lot of other people. Great wow. cinematography. Writing is sharp. Branagh is phenomenal at blocking for camera, if you guys are into that. Like, he has all these like long one take scenes where you just have eight different or like six or seven different characters just like sitting around a couch talking, but he makes it so interesting. It's one of the ones I had not watched before researching this episode, but because I loved it so much and it hasn't been seen by many people, of course it's not streaming, I pitched it. It's just one I hope people can find somehow and watch. So there you go. Peter's Friends, directed by Kenneth Branagh.
All right. Bravo. I'm going to pitch it. I'm going to do something a little different. Brandon approved it, so we can't call cheating later on. I'm going to pitch it. I'm going to pitch you two movies, Ben.
Whoa.
And the reason I'm going to pitch you two movies is cuz I'm pitching you the original and the remake. And they're both so close to each other, and they both have their own merits. So you gotta talk about both of them at the same time.
Okay.
It's the same screenwriter on both, so you gotta own up to it. You gotta give them both credit. And the movie I'm pitching you is Death at a Funeral, the original British version in 2007, directed by Frank Oz, and then the 2010 American remake directed by Neil LaBute. So it's about a funeral, obviously. Where a father has died, and his son, played in the British version by Matthew McFadden, which if you've ever seen like any Jane Austen movie ever, Matthew McFadden was definitely in it. That's his bread and butter. And then played in the American version by Chris Rock, a very dutiful son who's been like living with his parents and is helping his mom through the death and everything, and has planned the whole funeral. And then his brother, who's famous, a famous writer, swoops in and kind of takes all the spotlight at the funeral. In the British version, it's played by the actor. His name is Rupert Graves. If you're familiar with the BBC Sherlock show, he's Inspector Lestrade.
Yeah.
And so he swoops in and is kind of stealing all the attention. So there's a bunch of like brotherly tension going on. There's also it's one of those movies that like there's just so many threads going on. It's a really incredible, really both films are really well handled like ensemble comedy. There's these two guys who are just friends of the family who have come, and one of them in the British version is played by Ewan Bremmer from Trainspotting. In the American version, it's played by Luke Wilson. He's just come to try and hook up with one of the cousins who he's hooked up with in the past and is trying to like rekindle it. The cousin, who's played in the American version by Zoe Saldana, has brought her new boyfriend who no one in the family likes. And to calm him down, she's given him a Valium, which actually turns out to be very, very, very heavy acid. And so he's just on an insane acid trip through the whole movie. And that... Alan Tudyk plays the character in the British version, and he kills it. And you don't think they could ever find anyone to match that level of comedy in the American version. But James Marsden actually does a surprisingly great job as playing that character in the American version. And
I love Alan Tudyk.
Yeah, you gotta watch at least for him. I think he's the best storyline in the movie. But then the added. Kind of there's all this, so all this stuff is going on at the same time, and it all kind of collides when Peter Dinklage, playing in both movies, which is the best part, Peter Dinklage plays the same character in both movies, Peter Dinklage shows up and reveals to the two brothers that he was their father's secret lover, and he's blackmailing them for money because he was left out of the will, or else he's going to go show their mother pictures of him and his father together. So, wow. Then it gets out of hand. It's called Death at a Funeral. I'll just go ahead and say it. It's called Death at a Funeral because Peter Dinklage's character ends up, possibly dying, possibly murdered. And then it's just about all these different family characters, kind of all the chaos that can go on and all the different family relationships and, tensions and comedies that can happen between all these different people when a family gets together. And the American remake has like more notable names just because it's America and we know the actors, but there's also Martin Lawrence is in there. Danny Glover's in there. Loretta Devine is in there. It's like an insanely stacked cast on both ends. I've always heard the story is that Chris Rock really liked the British version and like really wanted to make the American one. So he got the same, like he was very heavily involved in the production of it and brought a lot of the actors on, for the American remake, but it's also a really interesting experiment in like script and casting because it's basically the exact same script, and it's super interesting to see two different directors and two different casts take on like it's such a huge ensemble film. So definitely worth a watch. I highly recommend both of those. Very funny, as far as probably the funniest funeral reunion movie out there. I'm just gonna say it.
You know, the fact that it is a copy paste basically right across the obviously a famous example is like the British Office, the American Office, those first few episodes are verbatim right. And then I used to use an example in editing classes with Broadchurch, British version and the American version, the opening 10 minutes or something are shot for shot, like the same tracking shot, the same walk and talk. It's crazy. I find that such an interest. I mean, the Broadchurch example is one of the most interesting in my mind because somehow the American one is awful. It's hard to pinpoint why.
It's a great, is it Grace Point? Is that the name of it? Okay.
Cause they changed the name.
They changed the name, but it is literally shot for shot. I haven't played them side by side. There's some changes to the music. There's some changes in the way that they kind of like cue things up. That's just kind of, the tone of it. It falls completely flat. Anyway, I like, guys, these pitches are targeted in a beautiful way at me. This is incredible. This is definitely the hardest choice for me that we've had so far. British,
both British.
Yeah,
basically.
The cast. Brandon, your cast, incredible. Kenneth Branagh, amazing. Stephen Fry, That's almost an insta-win. Let's go ahead and put that on the table.
Fry and Laurie? I mean, I'll give you that. Branagh, yeah. Fry and Laurie. That's insane.
Right. That's the thing. How could I not go with that?
And Emma Thompson.
And Emma Thompson. But then Thomas is playing hardball and bringing two movies to the table.
Two-stack cast. And double the Dinklage.
Oh, my God. Double the Dinklage. This... Can we take a commercial break? I mean, this is going to be... This is going to go to the edge. I love the two film pitch. I love that the rules can expand and change. I'm gonna have to listen back to the episode and figure out if I made the right decision. But I think I'm going with Brandon on this. I gotta give him the deep cut. Like, this is a film that I would never have watched without this pitch. I've definitely heard of Death at a Funeral, but the cast. It's not always the cast, but this cast. Yeah.
I gotta hand it to Brandon. When he told me this was what he wanted to pitch, and he told me that cast, I was like, "How have I not heard of this movie?"
Exactly. I think that's the biggest reason. This is like a 9.5 and a 9.6. You guys are both gold medal athletes. But this is just an extra twirl. It's perfect. 1992.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would never have watched this movie without the pitch. But now, I mean, Death at a Funeral, it could happen. It could definitely happen.
Also, something interesting. I was telling Brandon, the reason that I got turned on to Death at a Funeral at all was early in Netflix. In Netflix Instant, the American Death at a Funeral was one of the only decent movies on all of Netflix Instant. I remember people telling me, like, they're like, yeah, I just got Netflix Instant and there's nothing to watch, and I'd be like, watch Death at a Funeral, and then I went back and saw the British one after that. I'm that person that saw the American one first, but that's really interesting to think about a time when there was literally nothing to, I mean, you could still say there's nothing to watch on Netflix, but
guys, this is great.
Thank you.
The rivalry is growing. Mm-hmm. The rivalry is becoming.
It's apparently tied right now, is what it is. That's what it is. Tied. Happening.
I want to tell Ben the tallies before we go into the competition every time.
Don't lead me astray.
I was leading by one before this one, so.
Yeah, I was like, please don't go. I don't want me down 3-1 with this. like Jesus. No, this is one. This is why this episode is really cool, or this show is really cool. What we're doing with it is because I never heard of this film before the show, and I was like looking, I was trying to find as many Rini movies as I could, and this just popped up on a few lists, and I'm like, this again, same way that you guys are saying, how have I not heard of this? Because I really love Kenneth Branagh as like a, especially his early stuff as a director, that you kind of like, there's another movie called Dead Again that he did with Emma Thompson and Robin Williams that's also really good, and it's like, it just goes, it falls to the cracks, and yeah, so it's hard to find even to buy. Like, I actually bought it because that's the only way I could view it, and I really wanted to see it. So yeah, solid episode, guys. Mm-hmm. I think that was we're finally getting through this format. I hope you listeners are enjoying it, because this is kind of cool for us. So yeah,
trying to make the family proud. This is good.
All right, well, guys, thank you so much. To our listeners, please review us on iTunes, subscribe to us on iTunes. We're also on Spotify. You can download, listen there. Just give us feedback. We also have articles going up on Medium. We're trying to get back into that, but right now this is kind of our main focus. But we really just want to hear from you guys on what you think, especially when Ben picks these movies, if he's right or not.
Tell me why I'm wrong.
We didn't have a Dear Ben segment. We need some more some feedback from you guys. But yeah, we like what we're hearing. We hope we hear more. Ben Thomas, thank you so much for making this keep going.
Yeah, man.
Thanks, Brandon.
So yeah, listeners, thank you so much. We hope to hear from you soon. We hope you listen to more episodes. Thanks. Bye.